Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a show about gardening, agriculture, and wild habitat. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. In this episode, we talk with Willow Jones about fermentation and growing up in Ambler, Alaska. And Nicola Revelo has your rundown of events and opportunities in local agriculture.
My name is Willow Jones, and I was born and raised in Ambler, Alaska, where the Inupiaq people live in this state, and my parents went up there long before I was born, mostly to learn everything they could from the indigenous people. They were both really, really interested in the ways the Inupiaq technologies and knowledge, food knowledge, and ability to survive in that really harsh landscape. And so I grew up with two botanist parents who were also just adventurers who wanted to learn all about that. And so my mom wrote two books during the time that we lived there. One of them is about the traditional uses of the plants, the ethnobotany. And then her second book was about the traditional uses of fish, the ethno-ichthyology of that particular region. And so I grew up with that hunting-gathering kind of lifestyle, following the seasons, living in one place in the winter, another camp in the fall, another camp in the summertime, another camp in the springtime, in the winter. And, you know, we moved around sometimes four times a year following the different species of animals for food and did a fair bit of traditional gathering and fermentation in the process.
Are the books that your mother wrote still available?
Yes, they are. So one of them, the plant book, it goes by two names, Plants That We Eat and also Nuriat Nigenyaktut, which is the Inupiaq word for that subject matter. And it's available through the University of Alaska Press. They've reprinted it more recently. And then the fish book is only available through the Fish and Wildlife Service, I believe. And if you write to them, you can ask them to send you a copy. Or at least it's all available as a PDF online. Anyone can get it that wants it. The Fish and Wildlife Service paid her to write it so that they would have this information to be able to freely give to everyone.
When you talk about growing up this way, what are some of the foods that you remember from your childhood?
Oh, gosh. We lived mostly on caribou, which was, we ate raw and frozen with seal oil a lot of the time. And then other times we would cook it either over a fire or boiled or baked. But we did eat a lot of it raw and frozen. That was our main protein source. And, you know, that area where I grew up is near the Western Arctic caribou herd, and it's a pretty large herd of animals. I know it's been up around 500,000 animals or so. And so it was a big, you know, they kind of pass through in large numbers in the area we were living. And so you could usually get as many caribou as you needed for your family and your dog team to survive off of. And we also ate a lot of whitefish that we fished for underneath the ice in the fall time. And we would get quite a few piles of those fish. It kind of looked like firewood stacked up, you know, all these frozen whole fish that we would just pull out from under the ice. And we fed one of those to each of our sled dogs each day throughout the winter. And we ate them, and we'd either eat those raw and frozen with seal oil or bake them, usually was all we did to those fish. And then in the summertime, we traveled down to the coast and lived in a place called Sisolik, which was across from Kotzebue. My dad commercially fished for chum salmon in that area. And then we would always put out a subsistence net and eat the different kinds of salmon, sheafish, trout, flounders, whatever we got in that net. And we did a lot of fish cutting and drying and also ate a lot of sea mammals. You know, we weren't allowed to hunt them ourselves, but because of who we lived with there, my dad's fishing partner was married to an Inupiaq woman, and so we lived with them in the summers, and they had access to all of that. And so we ate a lot of muktuk that was coming down from Point Hope in trade, and also ugruk, the bearded seal meat that would be dried, and we'd eat that with seal oil, and walrus, and all sorts of things like that. I still have a certain amount of access to them and have them in our freezer, and my kids like them and we still eat them today.
I was going to ask you about if you still ate that or what your feelings were towards it. I grew up eating a lot of raw meat. My mother's Lebanese, and so we have a dish called kibinayi, which is raw lamb meat. And I occasionally go to the grocery store and get a package of ground lamb and eat it straight out of the package.
Yep. My dad knew about that Lebanese dish, and he and I used to eat that really regularly when we were working together in Los Angeles. And so, yeah, we eat a lot of the meats that are safe to eat raw, and my kids do too.
What are some of the meats that wouldn't be safe to eat raw?
Well, most people know about pork, of course. Not a wild meat here, obviously, but that can have trichinosis in it, as do bears. And so bear meat is not one that you would eat raw. And I've only recently learned in my life that moose meat can have toxoplasmosis in it. And so we're pretty careful not to eat moose meat raw, which is a challenge in our house. We don't hunt for moose ourselves because I don't really want to have a massive amount of meat that we can't eat raw, because it's so important to our, just the way we use food and how rare I like to eat my meat when it is cooked. And so we prefer to get some grass-fed local beef and hunt for caribou, because those are meats that you can eat raw safely. We eat a lot of the salmon that we catch raw after freezing it for 2 weeks, and then we eat it as sushi, and we're really careful about that for parasites.
You were talking about eating muktuk and other things. Is that a fermented dish?
No, the muktuk is not. So bowhead whale muktuk is eaten raw, usually. It's just sliced really thin and eaten raw. Beluga whale muktuk is often boiled for a long time before cutting up and eating. But as far as fermented foods that I grew up eating from that region, we used to ferment the little fish. I think of the Inupiaq name of them, the kalushraks, which I think are fairly similar to hooligans, but also herring, I think we might have done that with. We would get huge amounts of them in the fall time, and we'd put them in large bags or just layer them into a pit in the ground. And you'd have a layer of fish that's maybe, you know, a foot deep or something like that, or these sacks of these fish, and you'd bury them in the ground. And a couple months later, you dig them up and you eat them, and they've compressed and turned into almost like a really strong aged cheese consistency and smell. It's one of those foods that you don't want to be in the room with people who are eating it, but if you're eating it, it's just fine and smells great if you like that sort of thing. And, you know, it's a really intense, strong flavor, though, that many people don't like at all. But we made that regularly in the fall time when we were fishing for those little small fish. We would ferment them for a while underground.
Were there any vegetables that were fermented?
In the early summer, probably in July or something, down near the coast, near Sosolik, we would go out and pick sour dock, which is one of the, in the dock family of plants, that, not the dock that's around here. It's a specific one that has very different flavor than the dock that's commonly found around Homer. And we would pick huge bags full of it, take that back home to our camp, and chop it up really small, boil it for a period of time, add a certain amount of chunks of walrus skin and fat to it, and sometimes put some crowberries in there as well, or sometimes some blueberries. And we would ferment that, these huge amounts of liquidy, you know, cooked plant matter. And it would ferment through the summer, and then it would off freeze in the wintertime, and then you could chip off big chunks of that and eat it throughout the winter. That was the only plant food that we specifically did in that way that I remember.
So I see you have a garden here. Are you currently doing any ferments?
Yes, I ferment, obviously, cabbage, sauerkraut, kimchi. I ferment all of the garlic scapes that I get off of the garlic. I put beets in some of my ferments. I'd like to be growing enough onions to put in my ferments. I didn't plant cabbage this year, and I decided to just buy it from Willgrow Farms. I like those guys. And our family, we make about 120 pounds of fermented vegetables every year for our own consumption and trading and gifting to people. That's kind of the extent of what I ferment as far as vegetables go. And then Dave makes beer, and I make sourdough bread regularly also.
So it sounds like you really enjoy fermented vegetables. Or do you sell them as well?
I don't. I have used them in trade here, but I don't currently operate a business with fermented vegetables. I like having a lot around to share. And I have worked in fermentation professionally before in Santa Cruz, California.
What did that look like?
There was a company that was fairly early in its days called Farmhouse Culture. The woman, Catherine Lucas, who formed that company, I believe she's still going strong with it, and it's a pretty large national company now. I worked for her for a while. I think they only do a few farmers markets now, and they instead took the route of selling their fermented products, both kraut and kimchi and kraut juice, just as a probiotic beverage. I believe they sell their products throughout the nation and all the Whole Foods stores. That experience of working for that company was really formative for me because I took old knowledge I had from the Nourishing Traditions cookbook that Sally Fallon Morell wrote, her kraut recipes and the way she did it, which worked for me most of the time, but then there were key pieces of that that didn't always work for me, and I had a number of failed batches, and that's a really demoralizing thing to go through all that work and have the batch fail. And after working for Farmhouse Culture for a period of time, I haven't had a failed batch since then. I think I learned some really key things working there.
Please share.
So I think one of the really important things, I've kind of combined some of the things maybe from Nourishing Traditions recipes and Farmhouse Culture. I think the probably the most critical thing that got cemented in my awareness is using the right amount of salt. And so the ideal amount of salt is 1.5% of the whole batch.
Do you calculate that by weight?
I do. I calculate it by weight. And even when I teach classes here, I've often taught the classes at SVT in Thriving Thursday classes when they used to have them. And yes, I calculate it by weight. And one of the reasons I've been such a stickler for staying with that method of doing it myself and also teaching that is because I'm driven nuts by these recipes for kraut that say, take a medium head of cabbage and 2 tablespoons of salt. And I'm like, what is a medium head of cabbage? How many pounds is that? How many? And it would be a real hassle to measure how many cups of shredded cabbage you have. That would be a really obnoxious step to do, considering how difficult chopped up cabbage is to clean up off of everything. I take all of my vegetables that I'm going to put in a batch. So whether it's cabbage and apples or onions and daikon or carrots, whatever is going to go into that particular recipe. And I get a poundage for all of that. And then I use my calculator and I figure out what 1.5% of that weight is. And then I weigh that amount of salt. And then I set that aside. And then I start my process of making that batch. And I throw that amount of salt into that particular batch. And I taste it also. But between 2 and 1.5% is the ideal salt ratio to make a perfect batch of kraut.
So you had said that the salt ratio could be a problem. Were there any other issues that you encountered?
Some of the problems I'd encountered in the past with making sauerkraut, and I think these are common problems that other people also experience, is one, the batch can get slimy, or the batch can just get really soft and doesn't have a very pleasing texture. And another problem is obviously you can have a lot of mold grow on the top, or it can even rot and be really gross and not something you want to eat at all. Those are some of the basic problems. And so as far as the sliminess is concerned, certain vegetables will have more of a tendency to go slimy than other vegetables. So for example, red cabbage compared to green cabbage is a little bit more of a risky endeavor.
Oh, darn it.
So you can get successful batches out of all red cabbage and beets and things like that, but the likelihood of that going slimy is higher than when you're just using green cabbage with a little bit of red cabbage and a little bit of red beet in there for the color, but the bulk of it is green cabbage. And the softness issue, softness often occurs when you don't have enough salt. You haven't established the right bacteria in the beginning of the ferment process, and that can cause that. And so it makes it kind of mushy and bad textured. And so softness can be remedied by the right amount of salt and the right amount of time at the right temperature. And it's not so specific like baking a cake or anything, but you just have to kind of understand and think about the relationship between the amount of time you're letting something sit on the kitchen counter and the temperature of your house while you're doing that. And so if your house is warm, you want to leave it for less days at room temperature. And if your house is cold, you want to leave it for more days before you put it into a root cellar or a refrigerator or into some form of cold storage. Now, some people, some incredible fermentistas like Sandor Katz, who's really famous in the fermentation world, he likes to do a lot of fermentation kind of on the kitchen counter where he can watch it. He opens things all the time. He looks at it. He tastes it. I believe once he finds that point where he likes that particular product, then he would put it into cold storage. And by putting it into the refrigerator or, in our case, a root cellar, you can suspend it at that flavor profile and texture that you want. Whereas if you just let a badger kraut sit out at room temperature, it's going to get soft eventually, and it's going to get much more acidic and become, in my opinion, much less enjoyable to eat. It's still edible. It's still safe. It's still good for you. But I'm not going to get my kids to eat it. You know, it's not just amazing. Like, you want more of that. And so that's the softness issue, is to do with the relationship of salt and time and temperature. The other problems of mold on top, the way I've mostly dealt with that, the mold growth that happens, is using my husband's fermentation crocks that have an airlock on the top. He happens to make those locally. But you can also achieve that with a plain old ball jar with a tight-fitting lid without any special equipment. And that's the biggest trick I think I've learned between these two different methods that has helped me to not ever have a failed batch and never get moldiness on the top. And so I use David Kaufman's crocks, and I use half-gallon jars. I use the metal canning lid top and a plastic lid on top of that, not the metal ring. And the only reason for that, if you plan to eat it really soon, it's fine to use the metal ring. But if you use the metal ring and then you don't touch it for 6 months and then you pull it out of the root cellar, it takes two adults and an air filter wrench to get that lid off because it rusts on the rim. And so we've learned to use the flat metal canning lid with a plastic lid on top of it. And we put it on, we make the batch, we pack the kraut into there. Sometimes I'll put a rock in there, sometimes I won't. Sometimes I just pack it into the shoulders of the jar. You make sure the liquid is above the level of the vegetables, and you put that lid on, and I put it on tight, and I don't ever touch it or open it or look at it again until we decide to eat it. All the bacteria that's on the vegetables and in the environment and all of that, it's all present there. All the things that could cause decay or mold instead of fermentation, that's all present. There's nothing, you know, that you have to sterilize about making kraut. By putting the right amount of salt in, you give that lactic acid bacteria kind of a leg up on all the others. You keep it at room temperature for 2 to 3 days, depending on the temperature of your house. I always put something underneath it because it will leak. And we keep something underneath it when we put it in the root cellar as well, because it will continue to leak a little bit as it ages. So in commercial fermentation situations, the company I used to work for, we kept things in the fermentorium, the special room, at a certain temperature, I believe in the high 50s or low 60s. And we'd keep it in there for 3 weeks, and then the kraut would go into cold storage. Other companies that I know of keep their kraut in a fermentorium room for 3 months before putting it into cold storage. And I don't like that product as much as the one that has a shorter initial ferment time. I feel like it does something really, really nice to maintain the crunchiness and crispiness and the aliveness feeling of it. And it's not quite as vinegary tasting, even though obviously there's no vinegar in any of this. And so that's the time, temperature relationship and lid situation that I've done for using ball jars that's been really successful. And because there's outward pressure of these gases wanting to constantly escape, it works like an airlock, basically, and air can't get in, and so I never get mold in the tops of those jars. And so you don't even need a special, you know, bubbler lid or airlock lid on a ball jar. You just put the lid on tight and don't open it again.
Yeah, but I want a big fermenter.
If you want a big fermenter, Dave makes them.
Are these just pottery?
Yeah, they're beautiful items just to look at. He has some customers in town that have admitted to him, "I'm not going to ferment in these. I hope that's okay. I'm just going to put this in my garden because it's so beautiful." They're really beautiful vessel that has a handle that you can grab from any side because it goes around the whole thing, and the lid kind of matches the handle angle, and they have a good airlock on the top, and they make very good kraut.
Where are these sold in town?
Dave's fermentation crocks can be found locally at the Classic Cook here in Homer. He also can be contacted at david.j.kaufmann, K-A-U-F-M-A-N-N, at gmail.com. And his website is dkaufmann.com. And you can find any information about any of his pottery and do special orders, you know, if you want a particular colored crock or anything like that. Almost any size. 5 gallons might be the maximum.
So earlier you were talking about lactic acid. I'm not entirely sure I know what lactic acid is or what exactly is happening in the fermentation process.
I am not maybe the best person to completely describe all of that to you, but lactic acid bacteria, which has nothing to do with lactose, sometimes people get confused about the similarities of those two words. It's a whole family of bacterias that are present on vegetables. And so you don't need to add any culture or starter or anything like that. And the vegetables just have this on them, as well as the bacteria that are going to cause spoilage or mold. And so by adding salt to this mixture, you give those bacteria the advantage over these other bacteria. And so they're the ones that are starting to flourish, and they're digesting the sugars and the cellulose and all the little parts of those vegetables and actually enhancing the vitamin content of cabbage. And so vitamin C, for example, is one of the things that sauerkraut is really known for. It used to be used on ships to prevent scurvy on long voyages because it actually makes the vitamin C that's in the cabbage, it makes more of it. Those bacteria, actually, their digestion process is creating more vitamin C while they're doing that. Lactic acid bacteria, they thrive in an anaerobic environment, but they're not an obligate anaerobic bacteria. They also can live in an aerobic environment.
Anaerobic just means without
air. And so ideally, you'll have better success with it if there's no air in the sauerkraut mixture when you're packing it into a jar. And so that's why you pack it into a jar, not incredibly tightly, but enough to get all the air bubbles out of it. And that's also why it's super important when you're making a batch that you have enough liquid, and that liquid comes from the vegetables. You don't need to add any, although there are techniques and ways of doing it that use an added brine. I use what is called a dry salting method, and you can also use a wet brine method, but my dry salting method creates enough liquid. After a short while, liquid starts to pool on the bottom of the bowl. And then that's the liquid that you make sure every container, you know, crock or jar has a layer of that liquid above the vegetables. If there are vegetables above that liquid layer, they will tend to mold. But if you have enough liquid on the top, that liquid surface isn't as inclined to mold. There is a lot of information out there available for people who really want to get into the nitty-gritty science of how these processes are happening. And I took a 3 or 4 day class from Sandor Katz a number of years ago, and that was really enlightening. I cannot begin to remember half of the things that he said in that class, but he had some really interesting information that he's written extensively about the relationship between those bacteria and the flavor development that goes on. People are very fond of using a starter of a previous batch of something, and he recommended not doing that. He says you can definitely do that and have a successful batch. But he felt that when you use a starter to start a batch of sauerkraut, you introduce at the beginning a group of lactic acid bacteria that are already finished in their process. And he feels the ferments that are made by introducing a starter tend to not ever develop the full flavor profile. In Nourishing Traditions, Sally Fallon, she recommends using whey as a starter or some assistance to that situation in there. And I've never really liked krauts made with whey as a, not exactly as a starter, but just something to help ensure that a certain family of bacteria are going on in that.
I've always wondered if that was just a way to find a use for whey.
I think a great use for whey is feeding it to the pigs or something, or making Gjetost cheese, you know, the traditional cheese of Norway, that brown creamy cheese is made from whey, and it's delicious and amazing. But yeah, I guess I'm not terribly into the results of putting that in my fermented vegetables.
What are some other ferments that you've made that you haven't been fond of?
I've been taught or told that one plant that doesn't do well in ferments is kale. Although I have friends here in town who have put kale in their ferments, not as the major part of it, but they've had good success with it. And I've heard from people that, you know, professionals that do it, that that has a very high likelihood of turning slimy on you, which is unfortunate because, you know, there's always such an abundance of kale. So kale is something that can cause a batch to be funny. The other thing I mentioned earlier was if you use red cabbage instead of green, or if you put too many beets or too many apples or too many things with too much sugar in them in the batch, that can also create a kind of slimy viscousness to it that might be undesirable for eating. And the general rule of thumb that I follow, that I learned from farmhouse culture when I was working there, was that your basic recipe should be at least 80% green cabbage, and then you can make up that other 20% of the vegetables from, you know, daikon, carrot, beets, pickles, garlic, you know, things like that, whatever else you decide to put in, but have that only be 20% of what your whole batch is made of. And that's a really good rule of thumb for people who want to make a basic sauerkraut and don't want to risk having it go bad. It's demoralizing. I think a lot of people have tried to make kraut once or twice and ended up feeling pretty sad about it because the batch has failed. And I think that's, it can stop a lot of people.
You had talked earlier about how sauerkraut was used as a probiotic. What are some of the other benefits of sauerkraut or fermented foods?
I think one huge benefit, obviously right now in this current time of history, they're renowned for their, you should eat them because they're probiotic foods. But in reality, it's a healthier way to preserve your vegetables by far than any of the modern canning methods or pickling in vinegar methods. Those are not as good for saving the nutritional value of that food, those other more modern methods that have only come around recently with the advent of canning equipment. People never used to do that, and we've lost a lot in health and nutrition. And the other benefit that I think of is flavor. Fermented foods that have gone through that process are just, they have something special going on with them flavor-wise. So it's worth it alone for those reasons, you know, that you can take something like cabbage that, I don't know about some people, but I can't eat much raw cabbage. Doesn't sit well with my body at all. And garlic scapes, you know, they're great to cook with, but you could only eat so many at a time, and they're already all at once. And you have this great abundance of food, and you need to do something with it that's going to taste good later and be nutritious and carry a little bit of that sunshine and the glory of summer into the rest of the year. Anyone who has any desire to try to have food resiliency here, I feel like fermentation has to be a part of that. You know, if you're going to be sustaining yourself healthfully through the winter, I think fermentation is one of the only food preservation methods that has that ability. I don't hardly freeze any vegetables ever for winter use. Any vegetables that we're eating during the winter that we're not buying from the store are fermented vegetables.
How do you use them? Do you just add them to your meal as like a condiment?
Yes, I think so. We just put a jar of kraut on the table with every meal. And, you know, pickles also, lacto-fermented pickles. I don't usually cook with it because that does negatively impact the probiotics, obviously. And we usually just eat it raw. You know, we just put a portion of that as a condiment with anything. But yes, we put a jar of kraut on the table at every meal.
You had talked about how, you know, when you're making kraut, you do 80% cabbage and 20% something else.
Mm-hmm.
But can you make things that are just one solid ferment? Like, could you do just straight garlic scapes or?
Yes, but you do a kind of a brine instead of a dry salting method. You can also do a dry salting method. And I just this year for the first time made salted herbs. And so I chopped up all the herbs that I grew in my garden and I just packed them in a jar with salt, like quite a heavy salt to herb ratio. And I just use that in place of salt in whatever recipes I'm doing, and it's great. And one way that I've found that kind of maintains herbs, the flavor of the herbs, like they are found in summertime when they're fresh versus a dried herb. And so I've always dried those in the past, and I've learned about this new method. So I pack them in salt, and then I leave them to ferment for, you know, 3 to 5 days at room temperature, and then I put them in the root cellar. Learned about it from a farmer in Canada. She's Quebecois, and she said that's a traditional French Canadian way of preserving herbs through the winter.
Are there any cultural connections or lore associated with fermented foods?
I can't think of particular stories or legends around it that I've grown up with that I'm familiar with. I know they exist. It's something that's so old, that's been with people for so long. You know, people often refer to thousands of years as being a common amount of time that people have been fermenting foods. But I know, you know, the indigenous people in Alaska where I grew up, they've been fermenting fish like that for a lot longer than that. And I feel like there must be lore about it.
When people talk about time, it's only judged in Western terms and yes, not through...
Yeah, how long the people have been doing those things. And it's a lot longer than any of us Westerners can even imagine, I think. And so these food traditions are so deep in the culture, and unfortunately so many of them have been lost. And many people think like, oh, sauerkraut and fermented stuff, it's this new fad, but really we forgot about it. All of our grandparents, or at least our great-grandparents, knew about as this obvious thing that everyone did, and we have collectively moved away from it and forgotten about it. Our health hasn't done so well when we forgot about all of these things and we started jumped ship to canning, for example. And I think a whole other area of fermentation that I haven't personally gotten into yet, I've done a little bit of it, but I really want to get into that area of condiments like ketchup and fermented sauces and fermented things like that. That's a whole area as well of ways to preserve different products that, once again, make them probiotic, more bioavailable, higher levels of nutrients. Anything that's currently being processed and made shelf-stable with vinegar, all of those foods can be made with fermentation instead, and they're not going to be shelf-stable to sit on a room temperature shelf indefinitely, but they will last a lot longer than those products just left by themselves. You know, it's another way to preserve tomatoes and mustard seeds. And another couple who I highly recommend their books and just following them and what they do are Christopher and Kristen Schocke. And they are up there in my mind with people like Sandor Katz, with just so many different recipes and ways to think about fermentation and ways to bring that into your daily table and diet.
Can you talk about brine fermentation?
Yeah, so if you have a whole vegetable, say for example a pickling cucumber or carrots or things like that, or beets, and you want to just make a ferment of that vegetable that's not in a traditional sauerkraut kimchi type thing, the general recipe that I use for that is from Sandor Katz's book,
The Art of Fermentation.
The Art of Fermentation, thank you. And in that, he describes the traditional brine for making half-sour pickles that are common in Jewish traditional foods. And so you can either use a brine that's as strong as 3 tablespoons of salt per quart of water, or 2 tablespoons of salt makes what they call half-sour pickles. And that's the one we use, and we like that because then we can drink the pickle juice when we're done eating the pickles out of the jar. And so we take 2 tablespoons of salt, or 4 if you're going to mix it in a half-gallon jar. You just put the salt in there and you put water in there and you shake it up until all the salt is dissolved. And then you pack your jars with the washed and prepared cucumbers, whatever spices you want to put in. Some sort of thing with tannic acid in it is important for that process because that helps things to not get mushy. And so we don't have access to, say, oak leaves or grape leaves or things.
Oh, we have grape leaves.
You have grape leaves?
Yeah, we can give you some.
Oh, wow, that would be great. Grape leaves are a great source of tannic acid. And so you could put a grape leaf or two into a jar of pickles and it would help them to stay firm and to stay really good. What we often do instead of that, because we don't have oak trees here, which are also really high in tannins, is we just make a little tiny bag of black tea leaves, or even just throw a teaspoon of black tea leaves into the jar and have that be our source of tannic acid to help pickling cucumbers to not get mushy and slimy. And you can make those as simple as just cucumbers, water, and salt. And you might get by with that. If you add the tannic stuff, it helps. Or you can put any other spices in there that you want, you know, onions, garlic, dill, all of that. But that's just a really basic brine recipe, either 2 to 3 tablespoons per quart in the water, and then you fill up the packed jars of vegetables with that water until the vegetables are covered, And the same thing with those that I do with the sauerkraut, which is I leave them out at room temperature with a lid on fairly tight for 2 to 3 days, and then I put them into cold storage. And then when we're ready to eat them, we just pull up another jar and open it up and eat them. One note that I would also make as far as that, I know some people are very concerned about canning jars being under pressure like that, because they will ooze. Sometimes the lids will buckle. They're under so much pressure. I've only had 1 half-gallon jar break, and it was a jar that I had knocked against something kind of hard while I was washing them to get ready to make this batch. And I've had maybe 1 or 2 in all the years I've been doing this break, but they don't shatter the way a beer bottle would explode if it was under too much pressure, and they just kind of, the side will just break out, which is a big loss, but it's not dangerous. They can sound a little scary, this method that I'm talking about of putting the lid on tight and not opening it again until you're ready to eat it. The lids will buckle, they will ooze, they will hiss, you catch the juice, but so far I've found it to be pretty safe. I haven't had any accidents.
Besides sauerkraut and kimchi, what are some lesser known ferments?
Yeah, sauerkraut and kimchi. Obviously, kimchi is just the Korean equivalent of sauerkraut, which comes from German, of course. Most people are aware that, you know, chocolate and coffee and obviously sourdough breads and beer and wine and salami and cheeses, those are all fermented products. Soy sauce. There's another really interesting food traditional to Japan called natto, which is fermented soybeans. And that's one of the highest known sources of vitamin K2, which is fairly lacking in most Western diets. And so, you know, goose liver and goose meat and Gouda cheese and brie and natto are the highest sources of that nutrient.
Have you ever tried natto?
I have tried natto. Yeah, a Japanese friend of mine made natto for me once, made sushi with it because I wanted to try it.
What did you think?
I like it. I mean, I grew up eating all sorts of things. And so I like most foods that I try, especially traditional foods. I'm accustomed to those flavors and textures.
Nicole was giving us the thumbs down when you were saying that.
It's very slimy and very viscous. I could see it being not a favorite food of many people.
In the garden right now, so we just had a freeze and we have excesses of things. And there was a little bit of a miscommunication when we were doing our start. So we have some excesses of some things that I don't know what to do with now. We have a lot of Brussels sprouts.
I've heard Brussels sprouts don't ferment well.
Okay, so we also have a bunch of radicchio. I guess it's in the chicory family.
You have radicchio?
Yeah.
I recommend slicing those in half, marinating them, and grilling them. That's a really good way to eat those, yeah. Because it's so bitter.
And I think that besides red cabbage, because apparently all we grew is red cabbage, mm-hmm. That's like the main things that we have an excess of right now.
You can definitely make a ferment with red cabbage. Like I said, it's slightly riskier, but you can do it. And I think even commercially, I know Farmhouse Culture for a while was making a red cabbage kraut, and they mostly would get it successfully. But when you're a commercial enterprise like that and you have a failed 55-gallon drum of kraut and you have to give it to your local pig farmer, after a while, I think business-wise, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And so they've shied away from making ferments that have those types of ingredients in them that can be problematic sometimes. But for the home fermenter, it's a perfectly wonderful thing to use. It's good. I mean, it's beautiful. Yeah. You know, it's really beautiful to make a batch out of red cabbage.
So those are all my questions. Is there anything that I've missed or anything that you wanted to talk about?
I hope someday soon I can continue to do classes in Homer for this. I've often done a class for SVT, their Thriving Thursdays, which have been really well attended, to teach people how to do this. I think that's something I'd really like to be able to continue to do. I also occasionally welcome people to come and make a batch with me as a way for them to learn how to do it, because sometimes that's helpful when you're learning how to do a new thing that's a new food tradition. There's so much nuance to it and so much about the way things look, and it's sometimes really helpful just to go through that process with somebody else side by side and be able to see what they're talking about. And I hope at some point in the near future, I'll be able to offer classes again and have people come and learn I would like to see more people fermenting and doing more things. And along these lines, I think it's a good way for Alaskans to preserve some of the vegetables that we grow so well here, that do so well here.
Are there people in town that are selling their fermented products?
As far as other local people that are making krauts, I'm not sure, but I'm assuming that Love Farms is still making ferments and selling them at Woda Botanicals. And so that's a good shop anyway to frequent for a variety of reasons. I get a lot of different products there. They use a different method of making them than I do, and they taste a little bit different than the krauts that I make, but they're good. And those guys are definitely a local business worth supporting.
I've heard that you make a really amazing smoked jalapeno ferment.
Yes, that is the sauerkraut that Farmhouse Culture, the company that I worked for in Santa Cruz, was founded on. The woman, Catherine Lucas, who started that company, came to fermentation as a chef. And so she cares a lot about how things taste. And that particular recipe is just so good. And it's basically cabbage, carrots, daikon, onions, and smoked jalapenos, and of course salt. And the little secret is you have to add the smoked jalapenos after the initial ferment has happened. So it's quite a pain to make it. It's not as easy as the other ones, but I think is quite worth it. And I usually make about a 35 or 40 pound batch of it every year. And there again, I follow the loose recipe of 80% cabbage, and then the daikon, carrot, and onion is the other 20%. And then I don't have a measurement of how much jalapeno to use. I kind of eyeball that every year based on spiciness and this and that. And I usually, since I don't have a high tunnel, I usually buy organic peppers from wherever I can get them. And another recipe that I use that's a neat flavor profile to make, you can only make it during the season when you have pickling cucumbers, but mostly cabbage, once again, at least 80% green cabbage, and then pickling cucumbers sliced up, and fresh garlic and fresh dill. And salt is my kids' favorite. I think most kids that I know, parents are always astonished at how much sauerkraut their children eat at our house when we put that one out. And then another one that I make really often every year that's also a Farmhouse Culture recipe is green cabbage, green apples, so some kind of Pippin or Granny Smith sort of apple, and fennel seed and white onion, some kind of strong onion. And salt. And that's a really, really lovely sauerkraut recipe to have with any kind of pork products or anything really. You can put apples in most recipes, but I do recommend starting small if you're experimenting with a particular apple. Say if you have an apple tree, I would make a small batch with that apple and see how it behaves, because one year I decided to use a local crab apple, thinking that this is a tart, sour, good storage apple, it should work like a Granny Smith and a Pippin, and it did not. And they were so mushy in an awful sort of granular way. So texturally, it just turned out really badly in that particular recipe. And so since then, I've really stuck with the types of apples that are Granny Smith, Pippins, and I actually use what I call the Granny Jones apple, which is my mom's apple tree in Washington. So she sends me flat rate boxes of her apple from there, because I know that apple works really well in a ferment. It holds its shape and its color and its flavor. But those are Catherine Lucas's recipes from Farmhouse Culture. And they're good. They're really good. In fact, those are the three krauts that I make every year. I don't really err that much from them. Sometimes also I'll make just a plain cabbage one. Just plain cabbage and salt. Maybe plain cabbage and salt and caraway seeds, which is kind of the traditional German style, but I don't err very far from those particular flavors.
Do you have a fermentation station in your house?
Well, because we live in a small place, it's 20 by 28 feet, and there are four of us living in there. The kitchen table and the whole kitchen, obviously, when we're going to do a batch of kraut, it's usually at least a 25 pound batch. Up to my big bowl can hold up to 40 pounds, I think, tops. And so that's about the size of batch that I make at a time. So I go pretty large for home purposes. And then after I make that, you know, it's sitting out. We often put the ferments underneath the desk in trays so that obviously when they're leaking, if you've filled them too full, which I always do, it's a genetic thing I think that I have, filling things too full. My mom does it too. And so that's under the desk. That's where they go for the next 3 days after we make them, using the whole kitchen and the whole dining room table. And then after that, we put them in the root cellar. And fortunately for us, our good friends who built this cabin in the 80s were accustomed to living without electricity, because they also used to live up where I grew up in Ambler in Bush, Alaska. When they were down here in Homer and they had electricity, they were thinking that that sounded just awful to them to have a refrigerator and machines going on in the middle of the night. They did not want to live with any sounds like that in their house. And so they decided to build a root cellar. And so we have a trap door right in the middle of our floor. And you can step down a ladder and it's surrounded with shelves and it always stays a perfect temperature.
Cool.
And so, yeah, it's a really beautiful feature of our small home. And we keep things that don't need to be cold down there, such as canned fish or, you know, beer making equipment and all of that stuff, you know. So it's really great to have a root cellar, and it's really great to have a root cellar that you access from the middle of your floor.
So I wanted to have a follow-up with you because there's a couple things that I needed to ask. But first, I wanted to let you know that I found out the fish that you were talking about, the Kalushraks.
Kalushrak, yeah.
I learned this through several Inupiat dictionaries. And also, I read a paper called Whitefish, Traditional Ecological Knowledge and Subsistence Fishing in the Kotzebue Sound Region, along with the ethno-ichthyology book that your mother wrote. The Kalushraks are a fish called Least Cisco, and the scientific name is called Coregonus sardinella.
What we call Kalushrak there, which are different than the hooligans or different than herring. They're about the same size as the herring. That's interesting. Yeah, and they're the ones that we were catching were about, you know, 8-9 inches long, 10 inches long.
Also, before the interview, I was not familiar with sheafish.
Oh, yeah. Sheafish are really special fish that only live in certain rivers in the world.
One of the main reasons I wanted to interview you again is when you were talking about growing up in Ambler, I kept thinking, Ambler, where do I know that name from? And I've been hearing it in the news with this proposed Ambler Road project, which is a 211-mile road that would connect Ambler to the Dalton Highway. It would pass through 26 miles of the Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. And the purpose of this road is to gain access to areas for development of mines focused on copper, zinc, cobalt, and other metals. So first I wanted to know if you, as an adult, returned to Ambler.
I've been there, it's been about 15 years since I was there. I went several times as an adult since I left at the age of 12.
Is it a mining region?
No, not yet. There was, however, a long time ago, and I don't know the history of this at all, jade stone mining in the Jade Mountains, that what we call the Jade Mountains, which are, I believe on the maps, the Barred Mountains. And so a long, long time ago, there was some mining of that particular stone. And so there are large jade boulders sitting around Kotzebue, and there's a history of that. And then in Kotzebue, of course, there's some mining. There's Red Dog Mine.
So where you grew up in Ambler is on the Kobuk River?
It's on the right at the confluence of the Ambler and the Kobuk River.
And then there's also the Noatak River in that region.
Yeah, the Noatak also runs due west approximately, just like the Kobuk River does, but one mountain range over to the north from the Kobuk, and also flows into that Kobuk Lake area, Hotham Inlet, right near Kotzebue, which is part of the reason that that area was settled by the first people, because they knew that, you know, this is rich country. This is all the fish and the animals are coming through this area, and it's an incredibly fat, abundant land for sustaining people. Yeah, Gates of the Arctic National Park is there to the east of Ambler. And then below Ambler, there's Kobuk Valley National Park.
Is that where the Kobuk sand dunes are?
Yes, there's a huge, huge area of sand dunes out in the middle of the tundra.
So I've never met anyone from Ambler. It's off the road system. You said it had a population of maybe 200 people.
There were when I was growing up. I think there may be, it may be closer to 300 now. I'm not really sure, actually.
I'm wondering if the people of Ambler, if there's a dialogue that's going on about this proposed road project.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely people active that I know personally that are working on preventing this road project from happening. I don't really know what I think might happen in the long run as far as this road. There was a prophecy a long time ago by a man named Menelik who said one day Ambler would be a great city. It would become a big community, much larger than it is now. And I think some people wonder if that's how that is going to happen. He was considered a prophet. He was someone who told people things were going to happen, and they did. Some things have happened. I don't even know when he lived, but he was spoken of regularly. He was a household name that we all were aware of, him and his life and what he said about the people and what would happen in that region. He was just one of the ancestors. But yeah, definitely there are people working on preventing this road project from happening. Sometimes feels like, I'm sure, the Pebble Mine situation felt for a lot of us at a lot of times, of all this groundswell of people who live here, who depend on that land, you know, don't want it to happen. And we fight. And it sometimes seems like those powerful corporations that want these things to happen are just going to go ahead somehow and do it anyway. I don't know what the sentiment about the road is in the village, and whether there are people in the village that are in favor of it because they want jobs and commerce, or what percentage of the people are aware of what they would lose to have that road there. All the time I think about this, I talk to my little kids about it. My 3-year-old can tell you whether a material is mined or grown. And if it wasn't grown, it's got to be mined. I think it's important for people to think about that, because I know so many environmentalists who are anti-mining, and they're buying themselves a new raincoat every year, and they're buying a better car, and they're buying this, and they're buying that, and they're buying all this plastic mined stuff, and they just do all this stuff that is perpetuating this apparent need for these mined things in our lives. And I think that's something I really want my ilk of people to think about and wrestle with. We are driving it as much as the other. You know, we think of that person who's pro-mining as being this other sort of person that's wants to destroy the earth. And, you know, they have their reasons for wanting it, but we're driving it as much as the people who are pro-mining outwardly. I'm not okay with a road being put into Ambler at all. That would just crush me on so many levels. And we need to have those places that are just left like that. And at the same time, by me and by us saying that shouldn't happen, are we saying that we support our government going somewhere else in the world and probably brutalizing another indigenous group of people somewhere else to get that for us? And I don't want that either, but it's something to think about. When you don't want something in your own backyard, you're basically insisting it go in someone else's, someone who can't fight to not have it there. And that's a real thing.
And that was Willow Jones, recorded first on September 28th, 2021, and then a second session October 8th, 2021. Coming up next, Nicola Revelo has your rundown of events and opportunities in local agriculture.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits on local agriculture and wild habitat too. The Homer Farmers Market may be closed for the season, but you can still get fresh, locally produced food through the Alaska Food Hub. Each week, they have food on offer from a variety of local producers beginning at 12 p.m. on Fridays and running through the weekend until close of shopping for that week at 10 p.m. on Mondays. Here are some of the things you can find on the Food Hub this week. Jackaloff Bay Oysters, Copper Valley Smoked Salmon, chicken, goose, turkey, and house-made chicken stock from Blood, Sweat, and Food Farms. Beets, tomatoes, carrots, parsnips, fermented vegetables, and pickled garlic from a variety of local farms. Local berry syrup and jams from Grandma's Jam. Locally made cookies, chocolates, hot sauces, salsas, and more. Some of the items that were available this week sold out fast, so it's always good advice to check out the Food Hub's offerings early rather than waiting so that you can catch the full variety of what our Kenai Peninsula producers have in stock. In other news, there's a new grant opportunity from the USDA that local food businesses can take advantage of. It's called the Pandemic Response and Safety Grant Program, and it's meant to assist a variety of types of small businesses who have been impacted by COVID-19. The list of eligible food businesses includes specialty crop producers, shellfish farmers, aquaculture and apiculture, specialty crop, meat and other processors, distributors, and farmers markets. Small businesses and nonprofits in these industries can apply for the grant to cover COVID-related expenses, such as workplace safety measures, things like personal protective equipment, retrofitting facilities for worker and consumer safety, shifting to online sales platforms, transportation, worker housing, and medical costs. The minimum funding request is $1,500, and the maximum funding request is $20,000. Applications are due November 22nd. If you'd like a link to the press releases for this microfarm insurance option, or the new USDA Pandemic Response Grant, or to receive our monthly Ag Updates e-newsletter, where we line out all sorts of ag-related news, please feel free to email me at nicole@homerswcd.org.
And that's the show. I want to thank Willow Jones for talking to us about fermentation. Homer Soil and Water Conservation District and Nicole Arevalo for everything that they do. Local musicians Carly Conomac, Kevin Cope, Ryan Black, and the band Trial and Terror for providing music for this episode. You can support them on Bandcamp by searching for Glacier Maximus or Trial and Terror. Questions, comments, or to any Lebanese listeners out there, ahalo wasahalam, kivik seva. Let's eat some traditional food. I'll bring the kusa and the jadra. And that invitation extends out to you, Ambler Metals CEO Ramzi Fawaz. Email Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.